Exodus chapter 20. We're going to be looking this morning at verses 1 down through 21. So the goal is to get through all 10 commandments and still have communion this morning as well. So if that seems like a sizable task, it's only because it is. Hopefully we'll land this plane together. Exodus chapter 20. We'll read verses 1 through 21. God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God has given you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. Now when all the peoples saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled. And they stood far off and said to Moses, "You speak to us, and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us, lest we die." Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin." The people stood afar off, while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was. In our home, I don't know where it started, and I don't know why it started, but there's the tendency when we're sitting around the table for somebody to finish their cup of water and then to say, just kind of offhand, "You know what? I am really thirsty." Everybody looks over at them like they have two heads. Like, what's wrong with you? You have a glass of water sitting in front of you. And then everybody notices this glass of water is drained and empty. And that person will sit there and say, That was mighty delicious water. And then they'll sit there until somebody can't stand it. They finally get up, grab that glass, go fill it with water, and return it to that person who sits there like a king or a queen or a princess or whatever. They just hint at these expectations that are out there and drives everybody else nuts. And I just shake my head. How did this happen? Why are we doing this? This is crazy. When God speaks to us in the Old Testament, I'm thankful that he doesn't beat around the bush. Guys, when you got married, this wasn't the way that your wife worked with you. She would hint at. She said, "Wow, that glass of water was really delicious. I could sure use another glass of water." Bing, 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 bing. "Oh, that's my cue. I'm going to grab her glass, give her a glass of water, and go give it to her." Okay. Praise God, when he gives us his commandments, he lays it straight out for us. But sometimes we still miss his expectations in the whole thing. This week on Wednesday night, Dan's going to hit part of our philosophy of ministry, the part called the being and the doing. And we have the tendency, in fact, all religion does, to take those two and to swap them. In our understanding, and it's just built into our human nature, we see it that if I do long enough, do hard enough, eventually I will be or become. And as the Ten Commandments are laid out for us, God lays it out very simply. He says, do this, do this, don't do this, don't do this, do this. Okay. So in our expectations, in our minds, what we get is that if I can just do enough, then God's going to be satisfied with me. The point is, all have sinned and fall short of God's expectations. When we come to the Ten Commandments, the point of the Ten Commandments isn't so much the do or the don't. Now, hear me out, okay? The point isn't so much the do or the don't. He's going to take another 600 laws to help explain what these mean and unpack them, the do's and the don'ts. The whole purpose of the law was to show them what they're to be, what they were to become as the people of God. And remember where this section fits. They've been redeemed. They've been brought out as a people. Now, as a redeemed people, as a brought out people, as a holy people, here's what they're to be. Well, if you are something, it has to manifest itself in what you do. So it's not a disconnect. But the most important thing is the being or the becoming, because everything you do will flow out of everything that you are. As we come to this, I think it's important for us. You've seen the Ten Commandments broken down in different ways, I'm sure. You know, the first four dealing with man and his relationship to God. The last six dealing with man and his relationship to man. Fair enough. I'd like to break it down just a little bit differently this morning. This morning, for the next half hour, we're at the Mount Sinai with God's people. But as we come to this, we've seen in chapter 19 that the mount is now on fire. It's filled with smoke. It's belching out smoke, as it were, a volcano, without the lava running down it, because God is there. There's lightnings, there's thunders, there's trumpeting. And then from the midst of the mountain, there speaks a voice, the voice of none other than God Himself. A terrible, awesome moment in the history of the world. When heaven intersects with earth and connects in such a way that the God of heaven speaks and the mountain itself is trembling in His presence. At the end of this scenario, we see that God writes down what He's said on two tablets of stone and gives them to Moses. He writes them down with His own finger, carving it in stone that it might not be lost. What we see in this revelation from God is God is revealing to His people His will. And in revealing His will, God's words are revealing His ways. Yes, this is what you're supposed to do. No, this is what you're not supposed to do. But behind all of that, here's why you're supposed to do this, and here's why you're not supposed to do this. When we come to the Bible, it's not just to get, what am I supposed to do, what am I not supposed to do? We come to the Bible so that we can understand our God, who's taken great pains to span the gulf, to cross the great divide between heaven and earth, between holy and unholy. And God, who's taken the initiative in the relationship, has given us this word, not just so that we can understand what we're supposed to do and what we're not supposed to do. He's given us so that we can understand who our God is, so that in the doing and the not doing, we find out what pleases Him, what displeases Him,
so that we have a relationship with him. And that's what it's about. As we come to the text this morning, I think we're going to find four ways of God that are revealed in these 10 words from God. And that's literally what they're called. They're called the 10 words, the 10 commandments, we call them. But in the Hebrew, it's simply the 10 words. We're going to break it down maybe a little bit differently this morning, but hopefully it'll be helpful. We'll come back. We're not going to cover everything this morning. We're going to come down and we're going to break down this in the weeks to come. Not 1 week for every 10 commandments, all right? You can breathe a little easier. In the first 7 verses, I want to see that holiness is the crux of the whole matter. God had told his people, listen, people, I am a different God than all the gods. I am, they're not. And you are a different people than all the peoples. You belong to me, they don't. Holiness, and you're familiar with the definition of holiness, it means to be distinct, to be different, to be set apart. It's opposite of that which is common or profane. And as God introduces this passage, we see that God is holy. God is different. God is distinct. He's separate from any concept of what gods are. We see in verse 1 that he's different because he is a God who speaks his will. Verse 1, and God spoke all these words. Well, of course, we know God speaks. Keep your hands right here in Exodus chapter 20. Go back to Psalm 115. Psalm 115. For us, it's a given that our God speaks. But going back to the culture, the day and age, that was far more superstitious than we are today, even then, there was not an expectation for a God necessarily to speak. Look at Psalm 115, verse 2. Why should the nations say, where is their God, as though he were one like ours? Verse 3. Our God, our holy God, our different God, our unique God, is in the heavens. Our God does all that he pleases. Their gods, their idols, are silver and gold. They're the work of human hands. And they have mouths, but they don't speak. They have eyes, but they don't see. They have ears, but they don't hear. They even have noses, but they don't smell. They have hands, but they don't feel. They have feet, but they don't walk. They don't make a sound in their throat. And those who make them become like them, and so do all who trust in them. Our God is different. And when God wants us to know what his expectations are of us, he speaks. Now, isn't that a blessing? Have you ever gone to God and said, God, what am I supposed to do? Have you ever prayed that prayer? It drives you crazy. You're in the middle of something, and you know you've got his word, okay? But you just don't know what you're supposed to do. Here's the glory of a God who speaks. God wants you to know what you're supposed to do more than you want to know it. God is a speaking God. That's what separates him from all the other gods. He speaks his will because his will reveals his ways. His will reveals his heart for us. He's a different kind of God, verse 2, in that he redeems his people. He brought them out. And we saw the price of that in the 10th plague when God says, I want you to understand that all of your firstborn will be spared only through the shedding of blood. Life for life. Innocent life, spotless life for your life. Put it on the doorposts and then walk through under the blood. And those who are under the blood, those who are inside, having entered through the blood, those shall be spared, those shall be saved. That is the price of my redemption. Verse 4. This God transcends his creation. Don't make for yourself a carved image like anything that's in heaven, like anything's on earth, like anything that's in the water. Listen, anything that you can see in creation and compare me to, don't. Because I made all of those things and I'm so much bigger. That might capture one little essence, one little part of what I'm like. but it can never capture everything that I'm like. So if you worship me through an image, you're limiting your understanding, you're limiting your conception of who I am and what I'm capable of, what I'm like. You can't do that. I'm different, I'm holy, I'm distinct, I'm separate from my creation. Verses 5 and 6. Don't bow down to them because I'm a jealous God. This God is unique in that he yearns for relationship. You ever thought about that? Sometimes you feel so distant from God. It might just be a dry spell. You've not been doing anything wrong. You've not been doing anything different. It's just been long. God seems so distant. You just don't have that warmth in the relationship that sometimes you have. We just had Easter last week, and it's easy on Easter and Christmas to sense the presence and the warmth and the joy of the Lord as our strength. But then you get into late April and the soggy and the snowflakes, and or mid-July when the summer sun is beating down, and there's just a distance. And as your soul longs for a relationship with God, what a joy it is to know that my God wants a relationship with me. In fact, he yearns for it. He's jealous. And so when things come into my life that pull me away from my God is a jealous God, it's a good thing. He pulls me back. He sticks things in my life to break my affection with another so that I might increase my affection with himself. What an amazing God. He longs to have a relationship with me. If that doesn't amaze you, you don't know yourself very well this morning. Who would want a relationship with you other than your dog? Okay, but that's because he doesn't know you like God knows you. Okay. God knows you and still wants a relationship with you. What an amazing God. Verse 7. Don't take my name in vain. I'll not hold anybody guiltless who takes my name in vain. Our God is a God who guards his glory. He says, don't treat my name, don't treat my reputation, don't take that which represents all of me that I've revealed to you. Don't take that and treat it as though it was nothing, empty, air. The idea is just light, worthless. God's glory is the exact opposite of it. It's the idea of being heavy, of being weighty, of being very filled with worth. If you were to stick God's glory on one side and start sticking the gold coins on the other, you could never count the worth for the heaviness of our God's glory. He says, don't you understand? My glory is weighty. And the fact that you belong to me and I belong to you, that means a great deal. Don't treat it as though it were nothing. This God, this is the essence of all that is. This underscores all of these Ten Commandments. Listen, I want you to understand, it's me who's telling you this. This God who is holy. On the flip side of the holiness, it's not just a God that's holy, it's a people that are holy. He says in verse 2 that they're called to acknowledge their past. Understand where you came from. You came out of the land of Egypt. You came out of the house of slavery. You know what you were when I found you? Nothing. Well, doesn't that make you feel good? But you know what? None of us enter into that relationship with him until we get down on our knees and confess the same thing. God, you know what I am? Nothing. In fact, it's worse than that. I'm an enemy of yours. Thank you for sending your son to cross that divide and take away that which separates me from you and you from me. They acknowledge their past. And you know what? We don't ever enter into this relationship until we do. Just as I am without one plea, but that your blood was shed for me, and since you bid me come to thee, O Lamb of God, I come. And that's all we have to do. We just have to come, and then whoever calls upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. What an amazing thing. And when God saves me, He begins a new work in sanctifying me, but he justifies me. He holifies me, if you will. He makes me different. He sets me apart for an entirely different purpose, for an entirely different destiny. A holy God, a holy people who acknowledge their past and also appreciate their privilege. Verse 2a, he says, I am the God who is, Yahweh, I am. And I am yours. Wow. So when you were taking out your treasure chest and you're showing your treasures to your friend, to your children, to your parents, saying, you know what I got? Look at what I got. Did you include God in your treasure? You know what I got? I've got God. Oh, yeah, that too. Wait a minute. You've got God. Do you understand what that means? That God is yours. I love that song. Loved with everlasting love, led by grace, this love to know. Spirit breathing from above, thou hast taught me. It is so. Oh, what full and perfect peace. Oh, what endless grace divine. Since I know as now I know, I am his and he is mine. If that doesn't thrill you, you may not know this God. You may not be his child, because those who are his child know the thrill that God is mine. A holy people who acknowledge their past, appreciate their privilege, and accept their position. Verses 5 through 7, as he's giving these commandments, he says, I want you to understand, I'm separate from my creation. So verse 5, don't make images of creation and bow down to them. Don't you understand that I've made you the crown of creation? That I've made you the lords of creation? That I've made you the kings of creation? That I've given you dominion over creation? Why would you bow down to creation when I've set you over creation as those who bear my image? He says in verse 6, listen, I want you to understand, you, in particular you, I want you to understand that you are the link to the future. How is the future, how are future generations going to understand what my expectations are of them if you don't tell them, if you don't pass that on to them, if they don't see it alive in you? So, if you hate me, if you despise me, if you neglect me, if you treat me as vanity, as empty, as worthless, guess what? Kids will too. If you go out of your way and rearrange your life, including, he's going to talk about a Sabbath day, if you arrange your life so that all of it revolves around me, guess what? Your kids are going to see it. And your kids are you're going to be able to pass on a baton of a relationship, not just duties, but of what it means to love and please a God who wants a relationship with me. Their position as the crown of creation, the link to the future, and as those who bear his name. Verse 7, he says, don't take up my name. It's not just taking it up in my mouth. It's taking it up in whatever way. Connecting it to an oath. Connecting it to a promise. Connecting it to myself. Calling myself by God's name and then not living up to his character. He says, don't do that. You understand that as image bearers, you are also name bearers of me. I will not hold him guiltless who pretends to represent me and lives like the devil. I can't. It costs me too much. There's too much at stake. Holiness is the bottom line of these commandments, okay? In verses 8 through 11, grace is at the center of this relationship. We've got about 15 minutes to get through the rest of this passage. We're going to just kind of skip the rock here now. Just hang with me. We're going to come back. We're going to recircle. We're going to visit these again. So if we didn't touch on what you wanted us to touch on today, please forgive me. We'll do that maybe in the future. But when he comes to the fourth commandment, verse 8 here, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Sabbath is the noun. We get it from the verb Shabbat in Genesis 2:2, which means to cease, to stop, to desist, to rest. This Sabbath provides for man a needed reminder of man's limited ability. Listen, God says, verse 9, 6 days you will labor. That's the idea of doing service. And you will work. That's the idea of conducting your occupation, of performing your business, of settling your accounts, of doing what you need to do to live, of meeting your needs, of accomplishing your responsibilities. You've got 6 days to do that. But there's one day that I've set aside as a day for your rest. That day means simply to stop. Busy, 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 busy. Stop. That's what the word itself means. But as he comes to the word rest in verse 11, in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, all that's in them, and then God rested on the seventh day. He's referencing back to Genesis chapter 2, verse 2, but he's using a different word. The one he uses at the beginning means just to stop the activity, the motion. The word that he uses in verse 11 has the idea of contrasting with the working, the labor, the busyness, the heaviness, the beating downedness of the work that you do. The idea behind this is to breathe deep, to repose, to relax. It has the idea of settling down, of quieting down. He says, you know what? I want one day in your week to be different from all the others. You look at your life and you say, preacher, you don't understand my life. You don't understand my responsibilities. I've got, you know what? I don't understand your responsibility. I just understand mine. And I know how hard it is for me to get one day just to relax. The deacons have had to pull me aside at times and say, pastor, listen, you preach Sabbath, okay? You don't do it so well, okay? Guilty as charged. I don't understand your pressures. You don't understand my pressures. But it doesn't matter whose pressures. This is what God says. For all of us, all of y'all, whatever pressures are unique to you, you need to learn how to confine them to 6 days. Because if you don't take one day out of seven to breathe a bit more deeply, to look a little more clearly, you will eventually break. You will eventually snap. I've built you to need this. You cannot go on forever. It's a needed reminder of man's limited ability. It's a needed reminder of man's inherent dignity. Listen, you were made for more than just labor. And even donkeys, even oxen, need one day out of seven to rest. But you're not just a workhorse for God. We come down to that beautiful section where he says in verse 10, on that day you shall not do any work. You, or your son, or your daughter, or your male servant, or your female servant, or your livestock, or a stranger, a sojourner in your ranks. That means there needs to be a time, a place that's set aside so that you see yourself equal to everybody else. That age doesn't matter. You, your children, you need a break. Gender doesn't matter. Male servant, female servant, doesn't matter. Status doesn't matter. Servant, master, you need a break. In fact, being human doesn't even matter. Your animals need a break. Okay? Don't push them all the time. They're limited in what they can give you. Ethnicity doesn't matter. Just you Jews need a break. No, even strangers inside your gates need a break. As we break down God's law calls man to fulfill his creational purpose. And we can't do that unless we follow God's creational plan. We need a break. This Sabbath reminds us of our primary responsibility. we're to set apart what is holy. And it says that the Sabbath, verse 11, is made holy by God. It's God who made the Sabbath holy. Okay. He made it holy in his example. He rested. He made it holy by revelation. He blessed it. He sanctified it is the idea. We only know that because he tells us that he did it. God is the one who made it holy, but it's up to us to keep the Sabbath holy, to guard the holiness of this day. And to practice this holiness is to exercise faith. 6 days, I'm doing. One day, I stop doing. And guess what? The world doesn't fall apart. That's a revelation to most of us. Boy, if I don't, then everything's gonna what? Oh yeah, God's gonna fall off the throne because you didn't. We wouldn't say it like that. But that's what's working on the inside of us. You know what? To live by resting routinely, and I'm preaching to me, okay? I got one finger at you and I've got three fingers pointing back at me. To work without resting is to take a place of God in your own life. You can't do it. God says, stop, and guess what? I will do for you what you can't do. I'm going to recharge you. I'm going to give you new energies. I'm going to give you new strengths. In fact, he's going to build the Sabbath principle later on where even for a year, and sometimes every 50 years, for 2 years at a time, places are going to go fallow so that God says, listen, I'm going to give you enough when you follow my directions and you rest in me and you cease from your efforts, your labors, I will do for you what you could never do for you and could never do for me. It's an amazing thing. God says, listen, it's not about what you can do for me. Until you get it into your mind and you build it into your life, I want to do for you. You've got this whole thing backwards because grace is at the center of our relationship. Third thing, verses 12 through 7. Love is at the core of community. He gives us seven pillars, if you will, of community. The first is family. Is honor your father and mother. The family is the place where we learn what relationships are all about. I had a brother and a sister, and I'm thankful that I did. I had one little brother and I had a really little sister. She was 10 years behind me. I got to learn that life isn't just about me in the context of family. When I was young, mom and dad say to me, no, I can't. I find out that in the context of family, another pillar of community is authority. I can't just do what I want to do. God puts people in place in my life, a father and a mother, to tell me sometimes, you can't do what you want to do. And as a baby, you kick and scream and cry, and you do it in the grocery aisle, and then you get taken home and you get treated for doing it in the grocery aisle, and then you don't do that again. But that authority is so... We see our structure of our society coming down today around us because hooligans don't know how to respond to authority. It doesn't matter the color of skin. If God puts a person in authority, you treat that authority with respect. It doesn't matter if they're a member of your party. The president that we have may or may not be in line with your politics, but he is the authority that who's placed in your life? Do you dare say it? God. God. Listen, in order for a civilized society to function, there must be families that are functional. Guess what? We don't have that today. There must be authority that's functional. Everybody's an authority to ourselves. It's a scary time. There must be humility. He starts out that verse 12, honor. It's the word that's used for glory. It's the word that means weighty, heavy. Don't tell your mom and dad they're fat. That's not the idea, okay? The idea is treat them with a heaviness, with a weightiness. Understand, it's not just anybody. It's your mom and it's your dad. He's talking to adults at this point and children. But the idea is as long as you have a mother and father, treat your mother and your father with respect, honor. He carries this over in the New Testament, God does. When he comes to Romans chapter 12, he says, you know what I want you to be? Romans chapter 12, verse 10. The end of the verse says, outdo one another by showing honor. Outdo one another. God says, you know what? I want you to be a society that let each perceive others, esteem others better than themselves. This isn't just an Old Testament principle, and it's not really just about mom and dad. As he gives it in these 10 words, it's about mom and dad. But the principle carries over to bigger than that. If I'm going to have a society that functions holy, that reflects the holy character of my God, there needs to be a humility that says, I am less, you are more. That's a hard thing to do, and you can't do it apart from God. Another pillar that he gives to us is dignity. You can't take another man's life. Life is given by God, and it's not to be taken by man. Now, God puts authorities in place where if one man takes the life of another man, the authority of the government can come in and take out his life, and that's biblical justice. But the whole purpose behind this is, and the word is murder, it's not just kill. Don't kill a man wrongfully. He gives permission to governments to kill in a right way. But do not kill a man wrongfully. It's not yours to do by yourself with your own vendettas. Because the whole purpose of this is there's an image of God in that person. And only God has the right to snuff that out. Verse 14, the issue of loyalty. You've entered into covenant with a husband, with a wife. You've given vows, you've exchanged vows that for the rest of your life you will remain faithful to each other. So remain faithful to each other. As a covenant community, be characterized by keeping covenant and not just in the context of marriage. If you make any covenant, if you sign any contract, if you say you're going to be there at a certain time to meet somebody for appointment, guess what? You've made a contract. You've given your word. Let your yes be yes. Let your no be no. Don't steal from their time by breaking contract. You know what? There's nothing that undermines community more than treachery of breaking contracts with each other. In verses 15 and 16, there's the stealing and there's the false testimony. The idea is honesty in both regards. One wrongfully removes my neighbor's property, my neighbor's security. The other wrongfully removes my neighbor's reputation and his rights. We need to live in a society that honors honesty as we're raising our children. You have different degrees of punishment for different faults, but the greatest punishment always went for lying, because we can't function as a family if we don't learn to tell the truth, even if it costs us. Even if it costs us. God says, listen, you've got to work with honesty toward each other. Then verse 17, the whole idea of not coveting gets to the whole heart of what these commandments are meant to do. Don't just do the not stealing. Break it off before that. Let the inside match the outside. Let the heart match the actions. Don't even covet. So don't just not take. Work on governing your heart so that your desire is not to take. Man, can you do that by yourself? Nope, that's where God says, I will give you a new heart. And you have to ask God to do that. The summary of this is, love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus says, okay, number 6, number 7, number 8, number 9. Love your neighbor as yourself. You're going to get it, okay? If you think of them better than you think of you, you're going to get it. Finally, comes down to the end, he says, they listen to these 10 words, and they say, Moses, we can't take it anymore. You talk to us. We can't have God talk to us anymore. God, on purpose, terrifies these people at this point. He comes down on this mountain with smoke, with fire, with trumpet, with thunders, with his voice. Brrr, trembling earthquake. Why did he do it? God brought all of these manifestations of His presence, of His power, of His weightiness, of His glory in order to scare, to bring fear to His people. Now, there's two kinds of fears that are operating in this passage. The first we find in verse 19. Moses, you talk to us lest we die. This kind of fear brings with it a trembling, a shaking, an uncontrolled fear. It causes those who have it to stand afar off in verses 18 and 21. It says it twice. This slowly backing up from this threat. This fear misreads a true blessing. Listen, God's talking to us. Wait a minute. Like, God talking to this is awesome. No, we can't take it anymore. It misreads what is truly a blessing, perceives it as a threat. But this event was meant to bring about a fear, not for their physical welfare, but a fear for their spiritual welfare. Moses says in verse 20, "Don't fear, because this is why God has come, in order to test you so that the fear of Him may be before you, lest you sin," not lest you die. God gave you life. He's going to give you life until He takes your life. God's in control of your life. But here's what you need to be afraid of. You might sin. Does that scare you? Well, we all sin. God says, this is why I showed up. I wanted to impress upon you, this is what's really scary. This is what's really terrible. This is what really ought to terrify you. You might sin. As a holy people, you might sin against your holy God. This kind of fear brings with it a confidence. Moses says, don't be afraid, it's God. The God who's done everything for you so far. He's brought you to this place. This fear causes one to, verse 21, Moses draws near. In fact, it's amazing what this fear does. It sees through the apparent threats in verse 21. And Moses drew near to the thick darkness. And you can almost hear the trumpets in the background going, bum, 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 bum. Maybe they're tubas. Or the organ. And Moses goes into the dark where God is. Wow. You know what? The question is this. What do I fear most? Do I fear discomfort? Or do I fear disobedience? How do I pray? God, please don't do this. Please don't let this happen, because I'm afraid that if it does, I'll be uncomfortable. God, please don't let this happen, because I'm afraid that I might bring shame to your name. I'm afraid that I might disobey. Please guard my footsteps. You tell me what you fear, I'll tell you what you love. Do you fear unholiness? In 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 8, he says, listen, you need to be adding God's character in your lives. You need to be doing certain things, but you need to be becoming different. Because if you become different, you'll end up doing things differently. And if you become something different, it will make you to be neither ineffective nor unfruitful in your knowledge of Jesus. He says, you know what you need to be afraid of? Of having a life that's ineffective and unfruitful spiritually. Does that bother you? Do you have a fear of that? When God reveals His will through His Word, He is revealing something of His ways. That's why God doesn't keep His people at the mountain. This is a once-in-time kind of thing. But He calls upon His people to keep His Word in their hearts. As God gives these Ten Commandments, He's clarifying His expectations. Yes, you need to do, but I want you to be what I've created you, what I've called you, what I've redeemed you to be, in light of the God that I am. And so God clarifies this, what this means later on as we go through several of the different laws. Aren't you thankful that God doesn't just stop with words, that He sent Jesus? He said, you know what I really mean? Here's what I mean. A body I've prepared for my Son. who's not going to get rid of law. He's going to fulfill law, and he's going to fulfill law for you. He's going to be obedient unto death, even death on a cross. Wherefore God also highly exalted him and given him a name that's above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee will bow, things in heaven, things in earth, things under the earth, that every tongue shall confess Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. And Jesus says, you know what I want you to do now? Not with just words, but with a picture that I've sanctified, that I've set apart, that I've established for you, to drive home deeper what it is I've done for you, for what it is I've called you to be. I want you to look like me. Here's what it looks like. The men assemble in the back. We'll enter into a time of communion this morning.